This is the Brian Lehrer Show. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, filling in for Brian today. And just when you thought things were coming to a simmer in the Trump-Russia investigation, President Trump turned the heat up yet again. He admitted on Twitter that there were no tapes of his conversation with former director of the FBI, James Comey. And he told Fox and Friends yesterday that Comey's relationship with special prosecutor Robert Mueller is, quote, bothersome. Let's take a listen to that.
Well, he's very, very good friends with Comey, which is very bothersome. But he's also, we're going to have to see. I mean, we're going to have to see in terms, look, there has been no obstruction. There has been no collusion. There has been leaking by Comey.
So just how bothersome is the special prosecutor Robert Mueller's relationship with the former FBI director James Comey? Joining me to discuss now this and the latest from the Trump-Russia investigations and his recent profile on Mueller is Time editor-at-large David Von Draeli. Welcome to the show, David.
It's great to be here.
And WNYC's business and culture editor Charlie Herman is here too. We will talk a little later in the episode, in this segment, about how Watergate history can inform today's investigations into President Trump and his campaign. But first, David, you wrote in your piece yesterday that, quote, for now, the leak-prone administration has mostly gone quiet, the better to showcase displays of presidential normalcy. Of course, within the day, President Trump has kicked up another debate on Twitter instead. The president finally ended weeks of speculation that he had tapes of his conversation with the FBI director, James Comey. And for reference, listeners, the tweet is on May 7th. He said, quote, James Comey better hope there are no tapes of our conversation before he starts leaking to the press. Well, there's no tapes. So, David, what does all this mean? What was he alluding to about these secret tapes?
Well, one of the great challenges about writing about this president is that in the time between you write, you know, when you can write a paragraph and when you can actually get it published, he can, you know, change everything. We did say at the end of that same paragraph that White House aides were living in fear of his next tweets, and here they've come. Yeah. And those very same White House aides have been shocked by them. He started out by saying, look, there aren't any tapes. I didn't tape anything. And then he added in a second tweet a sort of very strange suggestion that maybe people are bugging him in the Oval Office. You'll recall that earlier in the year, he was suggesting that Trump Tower was being bugged by intelligence, and now he's suggested they've followed him into the Oval Office. It's a strange, you know, line that he's taking. But
because
what he seems
his...
to be saying...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to clarify that in his tweet, he's saying there were no tapes that I know of. There may have been
right.
Some other kinds of tape implying that he was being bugged.
Maybe somebody else is taping me, so I can't say for sure there are no tapes. But he seems to be saying that he was afraid that Comey was going to lie about their encounters, and so he tossed out the suggestion that maybe he had taped this so that Comey would be afraid to lie. Comey then gave his testimony, and Trump immediately called him a liar on Twitter. So either his plan worked or it didn't. It's very hard to kind of track these Byzantine theories that are created. What we can say, and this is crystal clear with each passing minute, is that the president is going to look back at his handling of James Comey, the abrupt firing, the multiple, back channel kind of one-on-one conversations, as one of the big miscalculations of his career, because what he's done is he's taken a relatively small investigation of the Russian hacking and the related question of whether any of his people, underlings, had been involved. And he's turned it into a special counsel investigation that is going to include questions of whether he personally obstructed justice. And well, to answer that question, if I could just say, to answer that question, the special counsel is probably going to go into Trump's own relationships with Russian business people, and that will involve looking into his private business, his family business, and that's going to be a much more painful and intrusive experience than the one he was facing before he started handling his own legal strategy, which is usually a bad idea for anyone.
Let me get quickly from either of you on this point about obstruction of justice and now this latest tweet. Wouldn't this be, if he didn't have tapes and he said, as Comey was about to go testify, oh, I might have tapes, Charlie, wouldn't that be considered witness tampering? Is that yet another example of being of him sort of putting himself in legal jeopardy?
I it could be putting himself in legal jeopardy, and I feel like you hear this a lot, people prefacing their comments with, well, I'm not an attorney, so I can't actually answer that. And I'm not an attorney, and I think this is exactly what Robert Mueller is looking at, which he's trying to figure out, are actions like that, do they rise to the level of what on the surface or what a layperson might look like and look at and say, oh, that looks like obstruction of justice. I think it is difficult to jump to that conclusion without knowing sort of the whole set of circumstances behind there. But clearly these are, the more he tweets, the more he is putting out a narrative, he is giving more ammunition for the special prosecutor to look at and to consider. And it's exactly as David's saying, it expands what he's going to be looking into, and I think he's totally right that looking at the firing of Comey is really a turning point in these investigations overall.
Listeners, if you have questions for Charlie Herman or David Draley about the latest, we're going to get into Robert Mueller. Oops, I keep mispronouncing his name, but we're going to get into Robert Mueller and we're going to get into some Nixon history. We need to take a very quick break, but give us a call if you've got questions. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. We'll be right back. I'm Kai Wright. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm sitting in for Brian today. We are talking with WNYC's Charlie Herman and Time Magazine's David Draley about the Trump investigation. This is our latest daily update in Trusha, trying to keep the policy conversation separate from the drumbeat of scandals. And David, we want to talk about your story where you really go in detail about Robert Mueller and who he is and where he's coming from. You write, quote, "The special counsel is, like Trump, the scion of a wealthy family raised at a boarding school and educated in the Ivy League." Tell us more about him and how he came to be the special prosecutor in the first place.
Robert Mueller is a Princeton graduate from a wealthy family, grew up outside Philadelphia on the main line. But unlike virtually every person in his social class in the mid-1960s, including President Trump, when he graduated from school, he volunteered for the U.S. Marines, and he's joked that he was hoping he would be put in an intelligence role, but instead he was trained in Army Ranger School and put in charge of a rifle platoon as a second lieutenant in Vietnam, which is basically painting a target on himself. Lieutenants in Vietnam were among the highest casualty rates in that war, and he was one of them. He was wounded in combat, decorated with the Bronze Star, Combat V, and other decorations. He did a year in country, and that really shaped him He's talked often about how he learned from the Marine Corps an ethic of national service, and he's basically been in public service for virtually all of his career, with some stints in private law. But he served as U.S. attorney both in California and Massachusetts, and he's had a number of high-level jobs in the Justice Department. And then in 2001, he became FBI director 1 week before 9/11. So he supervised the biggest change to FBI culture and organization in its history. He had to be a real ramrod. He wasn't necessarily touchy-feely with the agents, but he took that domestic law enforcement agency and made it into a global counterterrorism organization, and he did it by sort of force of will. So this is a formidable man. He's now 72 years old. He knows all the ins and outs of organizing major prosecutions, major investigations. He's surrounding himself with a staff that is, you know, trained and experienced in exactly these kind of questions that Charlie mentioned. You know, what are the constitutional protections of the executive office, but also issues having to do with money laundering expertise, with witness flipping expertise. It's quite a team. Now,
David, let me ask you about that staff, because that has already come up. That was also something President Trump brought up on Fox and Friends yesterday. That Mueller is a registered Republican, but he has installed Democratic donors on his prosecutorial team. And here's what the president said yesterday.
I can say that the people that have been hired are all Hillary Clinton supporters. Some of them worked for Hillary Clinton. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous, if you want to know the truth from that standpoint. But Robert Mueller's an honorable man, and hopefully he'll come up with an honorable solution.
So how much of that statement is true, David?
Everything except the word all. Not everyone that he's hired has supported Hillary Clinton's campaign. But there are several key people who were donors to Hillary's campaign. And there are several attorneys who have done work related to, you know, legal work related to the Clintons. So he's not all wrong. There's some exaggeration there in kind of classic Trumpian style.
I would just add in also that his daughter and son-in-law are represented by Jamie Gorelick, who was a person who was mentioned as a possible attorney general for Hillary Clinton had she won. So
exactly right. And another person who's a donor to Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton is named Donald Trump. He's given them money in the past. So
as he told us during the campaign, he knows how these things
exactly.
work.
Exactly. He knows how these things work. So what I think the note that the president ended on, I thought, was a positive one, that he said that Mueller is an honorable man and that he hopes he'll reach an honorable result. And I think the whole country should try to get behind that. I think as a nation, we're really relying on Mueller to do a thorough and convincing and transparent job that will not necessarily convince everybody, but that will be something that the public can understand and, feel that it was dealt from the top of the deck.
Charlie, for everybody, we are, of course, hearing echoes of Nixon. In addition to following this from the news desk, you've also been working with us on the United States of Anxiety podcast. You looked back at a piece of the Nixon era within all of this that caught your attention. Tell us about this. This was the enemies list.
It was the enemies list, exactly. And working on stories related to Trump and some of the things that David is talking about, when I heard Trump talking about the media as the enemy of the people, it got me thinking about comments that Nixon had said. And there's so many things that happen, everything David was talking about, tapes or things like that. It brings back to mind that era. And so I wanted to look a little bit more closely at this thing called the Enemies List. Where did it come from? What was it? Because it really grabbed people's attention. And it's something that you still see percolating in the culture today on television shows like The Simpsons, or I found one on The Big Bang Theory, where people talk about their Enemies List. So this was actually put together. John Dean, who was White House counsel and later testified before the Senate Watergate Committee, had written up this memo, and then later there were names attached to it. And this, you know, really sort of began with Nixon wanting to look at ways to use the federal government to go after people that he perceived as enemies. And when you talk to a lot of the people who have written about Nixon or studied him, you know, they talk about how he saw enemies all around him. That one of some of the words I heard were paranoid and unstable. And so once this list was created, there was an attempt to try and get the IRS to actually do audits of people. There's tapes of Nixon saying, what are we doing about McGovern, the his opponent in the 72 race?
Because it's an actual list of humans.
It's an actual list, 200, 300 names on it, many of them Democratic fundraisers or connected to unions or Congress leaders. There's also a bunch of celebrities like Carol Channing, which is one of the odder ones on the list. And so... there was a lot of questions of, was this actually used? And it appears that it never did, you know, go into actual operation. And that may have been because he was forced to resign. But there was this attempt at the IRS. The list arrived with the IRS commissioner, and he didn't know what to do about it. So he went to his boss, who at the time was the Treasury Secretary, George Shultz, and asked him, I have this list. I'm being asked to do audits of these people. What should I do? And Shultz's response to it was, do nothing. He basically said, this is not the way that we behave. And in fact, there is an interview of him from the Oral History Project at the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum where he talks about this incident.
When it came to anything of that kind where you're using the power of government, I think, and I held then and I stuck to it, that you've got to do it properly. And I was being asked to do something improper and I wouldn't do it. And I think things like that had been done before. And so maybe the president thought he was just doing what others have done, but anyway, not with me.
See, and that is really striking to me in the sense of, you know, this was it. We talked so much about institutions in the Trump era, for instance, you know, and how institutions
checks and balances.
Protect us, the checks and balances. But this is, never mind all that, it's an individual who had to stand up.
People face these individual questions of if they are asked to do something that they disagree with or they worry may be illegal. You know, if you're confronted with, I'm being asked to fire the special prosecutor who's been appointed on something, do I say no or do I say yes, I will go ahead and do this? So I think that's a lesson that definitely comes out of the Nixon era. You know, but, you know, you can only learn so much from history. I would just point out that there are differences clearly between Nixon and any sort of parallels that people may see on the surface with Trump. I think when it comes to the Enemies List and even the original idea that got me to go down this road to look at it for the Culture War series is that, you know, Nixon's list was private. We only found out about it during the Watergate hearings when John Dean revealed it. In the case of Trump, he has said this publicly, and in a way it feels, we have no idea if he's actually trying to use the powers of the government to go after people who he perceives as enemies. But it does seem to be more of an organizing, trying to frame the narrative, trying to
mobilize people,
trying to also discredit reports about him or his administration. In the case of Nixon, it was a very private thing, and people's responses to it, that may be a lesson across any presidential administration, right, is people have to make these individual decisions.
Well, and David, you interviewed notably Bob Woodward back in 2005, right after the news broke that Mark Felt was the former FBI official that we now know as Deep Throat, you know, the confidential source for Bob Woodward in Watergate. What about you thinking about the lessons from then, individuals and how the role they play and the enemies of the media has been defined as by this Trump administration? I mean, is there any echo for you, or do you take Charlie's note that we have to be careful looking back at history to explain today?
Yeah, well, we definitely have to be careful. But I mean, there's a hard lesson that I was surprised that the president had not learned at some point in his career, which is the intelligence community of the United States is not the right enemy to antagonize for anybody. I was shocked in the transition period, if you can remember that far back after all this happened, that President-elect Trump picked a number of public Twitter fights with America's intelligence agencies, questioned their patriotism, their loyalty, their honesty, their competence. And, you know, in Nixon's case, he wound up, you know, having a very formidable foe in Mark Felt, the number two at the FBI. But, you know, on a broader level, there's the fact that we've seen that Americans individually and as society and our government are highly resilient, and we need to have faith in that, and we need to take deep breaths from time to time and, you know, trust that individuals are mostly going to do the right thing, and that are institutionally, you know, we do have mechanisms for keeping things on the right track.
Let's squeeze in a call here. There's tons to cover, and we're running out of time. But Tom in Seabright, New Jersey, has a question about Mueller's investigation that I'm curious about too. Tom, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if the special counsel, if he starts looking at Trump's finances, how far back would he be able to go, say, if he was getting an influx of cash from illegal sources, or if he was taking much more for apartments so the Russians could launder their cash through expensive properties? Would it be constrained just for his time he was running for office, the time in office, or go back years?
Yeah. It's a great question.
Well, what we've learned historically about these kinds of investigations, whether it's called special counsel, special prosecutor, independent prosecutor, once they get started, they tend to grow and expand and go off in all kinds of directions. You know, I lived through an investigation that began as a look at a real estate deal in northern Arkansas and wound up as an investigation of an intern's blue dress. So it's very hard to say at the beginning where they're going to end up. But the questions that the caller raises, what are the business relationships with President Trump, with various foreign governments and or billionaires, it seems to me that it's quite easy to see how this question could lead in, into that. And once it gets into it, then there's no obvious point at which it would stop.
And David, I think you point out in your article, and we've seen this, that the people he has appointed to work with him, this is the kid, Robert Mueller, are people with experience in money laundering and experience with criminal prosecution. Those are, when you look at that, that indicates to me that they are looking down that road of trying to figure out
Shell
where did the money.
Corporations,
exactly.
Eastern European mob bosses, all the sort of expertise that you would think he might have in mind as he's putting together this team.
This, it could get real hairy. I mean, this is a man who was in real estate development globally for a very long time.
And for a very long time, yes.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. You can check out Charlie Herman's story in our United States of Anxiety podcast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and catch up on the whole series. And you can read David Von Draeli's cover story in the new issue of Time Magazine, a look at Robert Mueller. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And
thanks
you very much.
And thanks to all of you for joining me today. I've been sitting in for Brian Lehrer. I'm Kai Wright. Brian will be back on Monday. I hope you all have a great weekend. And hey, to the LGBT New Yorkers out there, happy Pride.